You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Okay, I'm Joan Rivers. I've got a cold, so bear with me. And I'm subbing today for Leonard Lopate. And we're going to have a great show because I have asked for each and every thing that we're going to do on the show, starting with I read a book about Johnny Carson by Henry Bushkin. Millions of Americans who welcome Johnny into their homes each night during the 30-year reign on The Tonight Show never guessed what a complicated man was underneath that Midwestern charm and wit. I mean, he kept a light circle about him. He kept a tight circle around him. No one really got in. No one really knew what he was about except one man who is my next guest. He was his everything. He acted as his attorney, his agent, his personal manager, his business manager, his public relations agent, his messenger, his enforcer, his tennis partner. They drank together. They laughed together. They whored together. They did everything together. Nobody else got near him. That man was Henry Bushkin. He knew Johnny like nobody else did. And he has finally come out, thank God, and shared stories and insights in a wonderful book called simply Johnny Carson. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm pleased to bring him here today on the show. Thrilled. I couldn't put the book down.
Thank you so much.
And it's on
I love hearing that, and I love being here. Thank you.
It's on the bestseller list.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you worried? Because you're the first person that has told the truth about Johnny, that there was a very dark side to him.
Well, of course, you knew that.
And
many who worked with him knew that, but generally the public didn't. And I think that he was an iconic star, as we all know. You know it. He was brilliant. But he was brilliant on television. Doesn't necessarily mean you're brilliant off television. You know many actors, great actors, who have nothing to say off camera.
Shall I give you names?
We could share names.
But when you met him, you were very, very young. That was also lucky for you.
I met him in 1970, and shortly thereafter I met you, I think.
Yeah, I was on the show in 1968.
And I think we went to a little club where you were appearing in New York.
Yeah.
With Arthur Cassell.
Arthur Cassell.
Arthur Cassell, as I
who
live
and
breathe.
Who was his kind of enforcer, right?
Right, for a moment in time, for sure.
And what, excuse me, I'm going to be doing this all through the show, but what made him so enclosed? Was he that way at the start? Because I was in such awe of him. You know, I never really knew him.
He was that way from the very beginning. When he did the show from New York in 1962, he was finished with the first marriage and about to begin the second marriage. And it was a rocky marriage from the beginning, and there was lots of drinking. And those were the days that he and Ed McMahon were virtually out every night in New York drinking. Dark days in that sense, but a lot of creative energy in the show at the same time.
And I remember when I was invited to his apartment in
UN
Plaza. And Joanne.
Joanne.
They all had first. Joan was the first wife who jumped very fast.
Right.
Then Joanne, who was the stewardess.
Right.
Who didn't wink, wink, know who he was when she met him.
Exactly.
I got her number fast. And then Joanna. But I remember Joanne sitting there and saying, we have no money. And they were in a duplex in the UN. How could he not have money at that point?
Well, you'll recall, I think, that in the late 60s, the mid-60s, tax bracket was 90%, and New York was the most expensive state. So deferred comp was a big deal then. Everybody tried to defer compensation. So he deferred quite a bit, and he had quite a little bit of income, cash flow-wise, but a great salary. And it eased up in the 70s. That happened when you met him. That was true.
Was he money hungry? Did money mean a lot to him?
Joan, money meant nothing to him. He was, once he had money, he never gave it one whit of a concern. He was generous to a fault, and he was generous to a fault if you didn't ask him. If you asked him, he wasn't so generous. It was one of those strange dichotomies.
What? You know, when he died, I know I'm jumping all over the place, and I have so many things to ask you about, but when he died, I went on the Larry King Show and a lot of shows, and everybody came on. Everybody was saying, we were best friends. We were best friends. He was a loner at the end.
You know, Joan, look, he died alone. Okay, so you start there. He died alone, and then there was no memorial. Now, what great star dies and there's no memorial? But there's no funeral. So no funeral, no memorial, and he dies alone, and he fades away. So we're talking about him now. It's a revival of sorts. It's a renaissance of sorts. And I think it's nice sharing it with you because you had such good times with him. People talk about the end, but they don't talk about when times were really good between the two of you. You know, and I like those times.
The times when things were good, for those of you that are listening that are maybe, what, under 40, he can make you. I went on his show once, and I was a star. I mean, it was an incredible moment if he anointed you.
Right.
If he anointed you and Ed Sullivan anointed you, you were set for life. You were done. And he had a great eye for talent, and he enjoyed talent. Very few of them do now, of the late-night hosts.
But that was his job, you know.
That really
was his job, and he didn't feel his job translated to off-camera. He felt that was his life, and he didn't have to give what he gave on camera. That's where people see him exposed in the book. And look, if you're a Carson fan and you held him on the pedestal, you may not like some of the things in the book. But he was still brilliant.
I think he was still the closest one, I think, now is Jimmy Fallon.
Mm-hmm.
And I go on all the shows.
Right,
I love Letterman.
Sure,
I love Jimmy
sure,
Kimmel. You know.
Sure.
But Johnny knew the best straight man in the world. He knew to hold. He knew when you were going for a joke.
Sure.
And when he would laugh at something you said, it gave you...
Sure.
You were never so happy in your life when he would go back in his chair.
Right, right. Jerry Seinfeld said the most nervous he ever was in his entire life was the first time he appeared on that show, which is sort of the feeling, I think, of most comics who went on that show. That was their livelihood.
And boy, we're talking, by the way, for those of you that just may have tuned a little late, I'm with Henry Bushkin. He's the author of Johnny Carson. It's an amazing book, an insight into what really goes on in a great star's professional life and private life, the good things, the bad things. It reads without a stop. What made you decide to do the book? And someone told me you had to write the whole book before they published it?
No. The manuscript was finished when they bought it, and they bought it they bought it as is. I didn't have to make any changes or anything. They bought it absolutely as is. As it turns out, I added a few pages that they wanted that told the actual end of the relationship as opposed to where I ended the book. I ended the book when he and I shook hands and never spoke again, sort of like your end with him.
All right.
That's how I ended it. But they wanted more of an ending. But no, they didn't. They bought it, as it turns out, as when it was finished. That's all.
How was he able, or could he have, this is a better question, I think, could he have kept his private life as private now with the internet and Twitter and the paparazzi never leaving you alone?
I don't think so. I don't think
it would have been a different story.
I don't think he'd be able to exist perhaps today. You know, I think he would be too isolated to really deal with it. I really do. I mean, you know, you've got to be out, you know, in his business. And in his day, he was out. You know that. It wasn't that he was staying at home. As he got older, as the show got older, he was more in New York, he was out all the time. You know that.
But even the women, you know, that everyone kind of knew he was a player.
Sure.
But
sure.
You just left it alone. I mean, that was a private thing.
Sure.
Tell about, you know, they all say all comics have such a bad, dark background. I'm still trying to find mine. My parents liked each other, so I'm already screwed. Tell about the Midwestern, the mother that was just so tight.
Well, you know, it's sort of a tragic tale of Midwestern, stern, Protestant, almost Midwestern, Gothic, God-fearing people, and Johnny came from a very, very isolated corner of Iowa. I think the most remote county of Iowa, where he was born and where his mother was from. And whatever tragedies she may have suffered, okay, she was so resolute with him that she couldn't pass on any emotional content to him. As a result, he never got her affection, never got her love, no matter what he did. And I write about some of those things, you know. How could you give anybody more than the 47-day cruise? Here's the gold American Express. Dad, buy whatever you want. See ya. And he doesn't call for 47 days. You say, what? What gives with that, you know? It's like inconceivable.
In the book, also, you said when he got back, he said, so how was it? And she said,
I'm so happy to be home, yeah. Son. She went to the show, and someone asked her, well, what'd you think? And she said, well, I didn't think John was very funny tonight.
And
that's your mom, baby. Come on.
There's your mother in gorgeous clothes, gorgeous shoes, new apartment.
Right.
But also with his sons, I found one thing that really disturbed me. We had a falling out, and he said I didn't call him, and I called him. First call I made, I called to say I'm leaving, and he hung up on me. And that's a whole other story, and I'm not going there now. But we had this big falling out, and I went off to Fox. And when his son died, I wrote him a note, and I said, I don't care what's happened between us, what you think's happened between us, but this should not happen to anybody. Never heard a word. I thought,
I did
who
the same
are
thing.
You?
I did the same thing. And I got not a response from him, but a response from, some assistant secretary somewhere to say, thank you for the call. I gratified? No. You know, was I happy I even called him? No. I wasn't even happy I called.
Did he? How many children were left?
Two.
Yeah. And was he talking with them? Was there?
Yeah, it was never a close relationship. I mean, you're a mom, you understand. But he never had a close relationship with any of the three kids.
Even at
kids.
The end, I mean, who got the money is really where I'm going.
I think the estate and the trust got the money. I think he died, Joan, worth close to $500 million or so, okay? Now, I think most of it went to the trust, and I think they contribute an awful lot every year to charity.
And she's living very high, the fourth Mrs. Carson.
I'm not sure.
Allegedly, I have a friend who is allegedly dating her.
I think
she's allegedly having a great...
Really?
Well, then she allegedly married him and is having an allegedly great time with Johnny's money.
Okay, well, fair enough.
Hey, listen.
Hey, what the hell?
Listen,
you know?
If you're good in bed, good for you. I'm speaking with Henry Bushkin. He's written about his years as Johnny Carson's lawyer and confidant. The book is terrific. It's called Johnny Carson, and it's published by, Eamon Dolan, which is an imprint of,
Houghton
Mifflin. And we're going to have more right after this break. I'm Joan Rivers, and I'm in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking with Henry Bushkin, who was a major, major player when he not only was Johnny Carson's lawyer, but a lawyer for a lot of people, a lot of power there in California. But we're talking mainly about his book on Johnny Carson. Is the age of a mythic star over, do you think? Because he was. I mean, you couldn't touch him.
I think so. I think in television it is. Perhaps not in movies, but I think in television it's not possible to command the audience that he did, the amount of people for as long as he did for, you know, he was the litmus test for the country for a long time. You know, what he said about politics, people talked about.
And
that doesn't happen today. You know, there's so many choices today. It's so diverse. And I don't know that he would exist today. You know, maybe it was his time then.
Was he right to leave? You know, I will leave when they cut my hands off.
I think he was wrong to leave when he did. I think he should have left years earlier.
Oh, interesting.
Because people such as yourself at the time, if you were being considered to take over The Tonight Show, you'd like to know when. You know,
yeah.
Like, okay, fine, but when? And if he wouldn't give you a when, there's no reason sticking around. And he never gave a when. I remember you referred to a short list at one point. Well, in my day, there was never a short list because there was never a list because he would never agree to it, you know, to leave. That was one of the problems, actually.
That they were worried about. That's
well, I think in order to have a smooth transition, you know, if you were going to replace him, for example, you'd like to know, okay, when?
Yeah. Well, that's what, and also, but they also get a feeling, like Leno, which I thought was hilarious, I'm going to leave in 5 years. I said, wait till the fourth year hits him. He's not going to leave.
Right.
That's exactly what happened.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's a way of life. It's an enormous power base. It's an enormous responsibility, and, you know, it's a great job when you think about it. It's a great job if it works.
What about Vegas? I loved in the book when you talk about no wives are allowed in Vegas.
Right, right.
And he just went and had a good time.
That's what life was like. I mean, it was the same thing for Sinatra. It was no different. It was no difference for Bob Hope. It was no different. Come on. It was no different. Johnny was one of many, but he was a superstar. So his life really deserves attention in that sense. But in another sense, that's how it was in Vegas in those days. You know that.
Oh, I remember.
You
know,
you worked Vegas in those days.
I was the opening act to
yeah,
all these guys
sure,
that were having a good time.
Sure, of course.
You know, the rumor was the top floor of the Riviera Hotel was locked off for Bob Hope.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah, locked off.
And certain rooms were locked until he got there.
And that's it. Was Johnny ever, and this sounds so stupid, but I met my husband through him, and Edgar said he wasn't inquisitive. You know, Edgar at that time, my husband, represented IBM and all this and all that, and he had so many entrees to bring Johnny over to Buckingham Palace to this. Johnny didn't want to do it. He said there was no say, oh, I can do this. I have the wherewithal to do this.
No interest at all.
No interest.
At one point, he was offered a seat on the board of Coca-Cola. And he turned it down. Now that's probably the most iconic company we have, and he turned it down. He said, "What do I have in common with those people?" I said, "Well, it's like two times a year, a couple of hours, and it's a big time position. I mean, no interest.
No interest in meeting people.
No interest. So sad in that sense because he could have offered up so much more, but he didn't.
And also could have taken opportunities to go places. He didn't like
well,
to
we,
leave
we did. You know,
south
we,
of France.
We would go to England for Wimbledon and the south of France, and we did go all over Europe. I mean, we've done that. It's not. Look, he was the type of guy that he got anxious when he was away from the show too long. I mean, that's just what happened. You know, he got nervous. I mean, he just did. I mean, it was like the lack of applause was like the lack of blood. You know what I mean? It was like he had to get back to it.
Now, what happened to the two of you? What caused the rift?
When the companies started growing in a very successful way, taking more of his time as a executive, after all, it's his company, and my time, not away from him, but paying attention to the companies, that's when we split, in effect. It was too much for him. He wanted the company shut down. Of course, I didn't. So they were shut down, and I left. And it was a three-minute ending, and we never really spoke again.
Did you see it coming, or was it a total?
No,
you talk about it in the book.
No.
I saw it.
In the sense that I knew it was coming, but you still are shocked. You know what I mean? Yeah. You know it's coming, but you still. It's like someone's really ill and they die. It's still a shock.
Yeah.
It was our relationship was not good at that time.
So did you meet at parties? Because California is Hollywood's a very small place.
Yeah.
What would happen when you bumped into each other?
We never did. There was a moment in time that we may have gotten to or left a restaurant moments apart, but we never did bump into each other. But then again, he never really went out to restaurants after he retired, only in Malibu.
So let's go to the four wives.
Sure.
How many of them did you know?
All of them.
You knew the first one, Joan?
I did. I actually did.
Now, did she end up okay?
No. No, she wasn't okay when she got divorced from him. She was gone a little bit.
Yeah. She was drinking, if I remember.
Drinking.
Nuts.
She was more like a flower child.
Okay, all right.
That took maybe too many drugs.
Drugs, that's right.
Don't know, but I suspect.
Okay. And then Joanne, who wanted to be a star herself. I was involved.
Well, look, I think it's fair to say that marriage was not a happy marriage, okay? I don't know that it was ever happy. I'm sure they were in love at some point. But when I met Johnny, it was no good.
Tell about the first time, which is hilarious. One of the early stories in the book.
That's how I met him. I was hired to go along with him and a private eye, Arthur Cassell, and one other guy. Traipsing across 48th Street to this apartment somewhere on East 48th, where she had an apartment, so we suspected. And we bribed our way in effect. And sure enough, we got in, and it was an apartment that she had decorated with all the stuff that was discarded when they redecorated the place, UN Plaza. So the tragic thing was seeing his reaction to his furniture and his mementos. Now, I meant it to be funny, and we talk about it. It's kind of funny, but at the time, I can assure you, we wished we weren't there, you know? It's like, it was sort of tragic because he was humiliated, you know, as anybody would be.
Oh, of course, you walk in.
Okay, so when he put his arm against the wall to start sobbing, I see the 38. Poking out from the jacket, and Arthur had a 38, and the private eye had a 38, and it was like a very strange circumstance. But we got the evidence, and of course Frank Gifford. Frank Gifford doesn't remember the affair.
Yeah, she was keeping
I think you must be amused by that.
I think it's hilarious that he said, I don't remember. And that was Joanne.
I think the publisher was delighted when he said that comment. That was worth news for a couple of days.
And then Joanna. And Joanna once said to me, this was the third wife now, she once said, I don't know where we were, and she said to me, he can bring all the hookers he wants into the house. I'm going to die, Mrs. Carson. I was in shock. I was a nice Jewish girl who just came to California.
Well,
he was really cheating around Joanna in those days.
Well, look, Joanna was a very sophisticated lady. I mean, come on. She was, and she was very good at getting right in there on the social strata. You know that.
Yes, very
good. She loved being Mrs. Carson. And the problem with loving being Mrs. Carson is that sometimes you feel that you really are Mrs. Carson, and therefore you're entitled to be the president of Cher, and you're the you should be in the design business. And all of a sudden, Mr. Carson isn't so happy, you know.
Tell about how she got. First of all, this is Joan Rivers, and we're talking to you just so that you know. We're on WNYC and WNYC.org. If you go into the internet, I'm talking with Henry Bushkin, and we're talking about the Johnny Carson book, which he wrote, called good title, Johnny Carson. You don't screw around with titles.
Thanks to the publisher. That wasn't my original title, but that's the
What was your original title? We'll go back to Joanna.
A Hard Act to Follow.
This is a better title.
I agree.
I agree. Just let them know what it's about.
I agree.
Go on. So Joanna, which was the third wife, she wanted to be very, very social and wanted the power that came with Mrs. Carson and was unhappy when Mrs. McMahon got a seat ahead of her at the Academy Awards.
It was at the inauguration of President Reagan. But that's the bit. She was maybe by happenstance, maybe three rows
behind
ahead of Joanna. Well, three rows behind Victoria McMahon, who happened to be seated with Frank Sinatra's wife, Barbara, because they really were friends, you know, and she happened to be seating with Sinatra, who happened to be the producer, who happened to command. So Joanna was aggravated. It caused an entire eruption later that evening. It led to great difficulty between myself and Carson, and it led to the president calling Carson and apologizing for the seating. And when I wrote that, I wrote it to say, wow, it's the power of Carson. This is the power of this guy. And then I said, wait a second, this also shows how fragile relationships are. I mean, we had just kicked the hell out of NBC, got ownership of The Tonight Show, and all of a sudden my job was on the line because of a poor seat. You know, it's like, give me a break.
And
that's how I wrote it.
And the book, well, the book doesn't stop. I think he's so honest in the book. What did you leave out? And you're not going to tell me, but I'm still going to ask you. Can you tell me anything that you thought I should leave this out?
Yeah, there were many things that I sort of knew about that I never saw firsthand, that I didn't want to write as a memoir that I participated in or saw in any way. I knew it went on, you know, and others have reported it. Others have written about it. And so it's not that I have any secrets to share, but it's moments that I found out about that may be shared by others, but certainly not by me. So, I left names out, and I left moments out that were so embarrassing that you just don't want. I didn't think I wrote anything that was terribly embarrassing, to tell you the truth.
In
the scheme of things, I'll give you Joanna Carson.
All right.
Though. I'll give you Joanna Carson when asked about the book. Her only concern was how she looked in the pictures. And that was it.
I get it.
And if you look, she looks pretty good in the pictures.
Yeah, she was great looking, yeah.
So I think she loved the book.
What happened? You were so powerful. I mean, you were big time power. Now you break with Johnny. Who stayed friends and who was scared to?
Nobody from The Tonight Show ever called me again. Okay, so we'll take Peter LaSalle.
Oh, there were two producers, Peter LaSalle and Freddy Cordova, never spoke to me again when I left.
Okay.
Ever.
Okay, so Peter LaSalle, for many years, you know this, he was the associate producer. And nobody quite knew what Peter LaSalle did because Freddy really did everything. And time and time again, we would save his job because NBC thought it was superfluous. Then he doesn't return phone calls, and then he becomes, I think, David Letterman's producer.
Yeah.
Now he's off to Craig Ferguson.
Yeah.
And, never heard a word to the man of born, I guess.
Naughty, naughty, naughty.
Yeah, I never heard from Bobby Quinn again. I never heard from Freddie DeCordova again. I never heard from anybody again. But I think that was par for the course.
I was having lunch in the Beverly Hills Hotel, and it was right after I'd done the break, and I'd been fired. Eddie committed suicide. My career was in the toilet. And Ed McMahon saw me and got up and walked across the whole restaurant to say hello. And that was probably the bravest thing he ever did in his life because he knew when we'd get back to Johnny that he said hello.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you shouldn't be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you, nobody, that was it. You were
dead. Right. It wasn't so much that they didn't want to do it. They were scared if they did and he found out. You're absolutely right.
He was very, very, he kept grudges.
He was not willing to look at anything other than black or white. You know, I mean, if that person's out of my life, he's out of your life as well.
It's like choose.
Yeah, right.
What happened to you after that? How many clients stayed with you? How many clients left? Because you had this huge law practice, but you also had that great power base.
Well, it wasn't so much a question of clients. It was a question of lawyers because my time was mostly devoted to Johnny. You were a client of the firm for a while.
Yes.
Okay.
But you never got good service because you were busy with Johnny.
Okay. So whatever, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, another good name, was a client of mine, but I didn't have time. So invariably, those clients now were aligned with other partners. So when when my career with him was over, basically my showbiz career was over. I mean, that was basically it. And happily so, by the way. I mean, I wasn't unhappy to leave.
Let me ask you
The book brought me back, by the way.
Now, what is the book? Who has called you that you didn't think would call you now that the book has come out? Joanna called and said, how do I look?
I've heard literally from no one from the Carson side. Not one, but there's no one to hear from. You know what I mean? Who's there? I mean, the two sons are voiceless. I mean, they don't speak, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
They just don't have anything to say. And the nephew lives in Fullerton, and he lives at the airport so he could fly his plane in and out. That's his life. And the two lawyers that run the estate, I don't think ever met Carson. So when you talk about who called, who was there to call, you know? And so I never, I've heard from thousands of people, you know, I've heard from not one single late night talk show host, not one.
Not one.
Not one, nor has one sort of even mentioned the book. Now, I'll give you an example. David Letterman, the book is now number one on the bestseller list. Okay, the New York Times has reviewed it. They love the book, thank goodness. And David Letterman, would he talk about the book? He has Carrot Top on talking about a pillow where a bag pops out of the pillow where you put over your date's head if you wake up and she's really ugly. That's what they talked about. But they didn't talk about Carson. They didn't talk about the subject because, you see, every one of them would have to acknowledge that he was really better than they are.
Yeah.
And they don't want to do that. That's my conclusion. And that's the conclusion of most everybody I talk to when we talk about this phenomenon, because I've heard from literally thousands. You know, the book has been reviewed by thousands of people. Amazon reviewers, you know, all over the world, people have reviewed the book. Not one late-night talk show, and I'm writing about that phenomenon, that they don't want to talk about him. They just don't, because David Letterman said, given the choice, I'd watch Carson. So, you know, he's like still a threat. He's still a threat.
And still so above everything.
He looms.
And
isn't it cool in a certain way that we're talking about him, that he's having sort of a renaissance? Because he sort of faded away.
Look,
let's face it,
he faded away. But also you look back and you realize he set the bar.
Yeah.
And nobody is, that's, what a pleasure talking to you. I'm talking with Henry Bushkin, author of Johnny Carson. I am Joan Rivers, and I think I have to read, this is the end? All right. A joy and a pleasure. I could talk to you for the hour, but unfortunately my best friend Margie Stern is coming up next and she'll kill me.
I'll excuse you. It's okay.
Thank you very much. She's a wonderful woman. She's a great philanthropist. She gives underprivileged children a leg up through education. She owns a Manhattan store called A Time for Children, which teaches people how to be sales ladies. It's the old story, don't give a man a fish, teach him how to fish. She teaches everyone that comes into a store how to run a store, how to do a store, how to deal with people, and then she donates all the profits of the store to the Children's Aid Society of New York. So we're going to hear from her and two of the kids that she has helped totally change their lives. And later on, of course, comedians Dion Cole, Billy Eichner, and Reza Farahan will take on what comedy's like today. And also, fascinating book, The Siege, 68 Hours Inside the Taj Hotel. People killed, four son-of-a-bitch terrorists did it. Unbelievable. We'll be right back. It's Joan Rivers. Again, thank you so much. We're here on WNYC, and Henry Bushkin, a joy and a pleasure.
Thank you so much.